Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two American soldiers have died in a bomb attack in southern Afghanistan today, which makes this month the deadliest for U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. The total number of U.S. troops killed there since 2001 is now 753. Meantime, an American soldier remains in captivity after he was kidnapped near his base in Afghanistan just over 3 weeks ago. Private First Class Bo Bergdahl of Idaho is believed to be in the hands of a Taliban terrorist group known as the Haqqani Network. Bergdahl's captors released a 28-minute video showing a nervous and visibly frightened young man speaking to friends, family, and to the American people.
To my fellow Americans who have loved ones over here, who know what it's like to miss them, you have the power to make our government bring them home. Please bring us home.
There are few people in the world who can relate to what Private Bergdahl might be going through, let alone anybody who's lived to tell about it. But Sean Langan is one of those people. He's a British award-winning documentary filmmaker who spent most of his career working in war zones and other risky places. And just over a year ago, he spent 3 months in captivity held by the Haqqani Network in Pakistan. And Sean Langan joins us from the BBC studios in London. Sean, welcome.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks.
I want to get your thoughts about Private Bergdahl in just a moment, but first, your personal story. As I understand it, in late March of 2008, you managed to arrange an interview with Siraj Haqqani, the leader of the Haqqani Network, and tell us who he is exactly.
Siraj Haqqani, who is one of the leading lights of the Taliban, is a man I think the world will hear more and more over time. He's definitely positioning himself. He's now called Khalifa, the emir, the leader. And he's been very successful and very efficient and you know, obviously very violent.
Right, and he's the son of Jalaluddin Haqqani. His father was very well known.
One of the great leaders of the Mujahideen when they were called freedom fighters fighting against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And then Jalaluddin Haqqani, supported by America, he was one of the leaders of the jihad in that time and heavily funded by the Saudis and the Americans. And after that, he linked up with the Taliban and in the end was part of their ruling group during their time in office, as it were, when they were in power in Afghanistan. And again, now he's kind of in semi-retirement. He's also closely linked to Osama bin Laden, and that's why it's believed the Haqqani Network are linked with Osama and protecting him, because he had very close links with them traditionally. Mm-hmm. And Siraj Haqqani is turning out to be the real successor of his father, and I think his father, it said, is leaving more and more of the running of that network to his son.
And now let's get to your story, Sean. You're going to this interview in a very dangerous region of Pakistan, a region where no Western journalist has been since 2001. And you're no stranger to the Taliban. You've worked with them before, right?
Yes, I'd made a number of documentaries about the Taliban, filming with them in their bases in Afghanistan, and decided to go one step further and cross the border into the tribal areas in Pakistan, in an attempt to film their secret bases, training camps. And part of the agreement I had with the Taliban, or I thought I had, was to also interview Siraj Haqqani. It's Barack Obama has described it as the most dangerous place in the world, with good reason. It's the federally administered tribal areas, Waziristan, Bajor, where I was held. And it's really the command and control for the Taliban, but also it's the headquarters and secret bases for Al-Qaeda, and it's believed Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden.
Okay, so you're telling me all this, and I'm saying, what were you thinking?
Yeah, with hindsight, you know, for many years I've been doing similar stories, and I was always aware that when it went well, I would win an award, and when it went badly, it would go very badly, and you'd wonder what on earth you were doing. And I do have two children, so I've decided enough's enough. But it wasn't a bungee jumping exercise. It was at that point to highlight what I thought was important to highlight. They talk about the front line, U.S. soldiers now pouring into Afghanistan in this surge. And yet, as one U.S. general described, what NATO's doing in Afghanistan is rather like mowing the lawn, that the seeds are sown in Pakistan across the border.
So you arranged this interview with Siraj Haqqani because you want to talk about this.
In his group
and what's going on over there.
Yeah.
You get into a place where you think this interview is going to be taking place. You're with your translator. And when do you realize that this is a kidnapping situation?
You know, I think most normal people would have realized they'd been kidnapped a long time before I had been. Because, in fact, often when you're filming with the Taliban, you know, in the past, I'd been blindfolded, I'd been stuffed in the back of cars. And I always remember thinking if I'm ever kidnapped, it would feel rather like this. So in a way, it was less of a shocking experience for me because, in fact, for the first few days, they maintained this pretense when we were traveling up through the tribal areas into the mountains of Bajur that filming was going to go ahead. And then they put me in a house and locked me in a room and said, this is for your security, our security. And 3 days later, the Taliban entered and accused me and my Afghan translator of being foreign spies. And that's a death sentence, as far as Afghans are concerned. If the Taliban accuse you of spying, there's no recourse. And so it was downhill from then on for my translator. He suffered greatly psychologically. And then we were kept locked up for 3 months.
And what did you do during the day while you were locked up there?
You know, watching the video of the American soldier brought back a lot of memories, but I was in a dark room with very little light, and it was a family home. The Taliban would come and go, so I could hear outside in the courtyard children, chickens, goats. I could hear the women work in the fields outside harvesting wheat and opium, and I was surrounded by Taliban training camps because you could hear the test firing almost continuously. And then at night, the other sounds of this particular rural idyll would be the US spy drones flying overhead. The family fed me, provided me with cigarettes, which I don't think an American kidnapper would probably do, health conscious. But it was tough, and my translator had a nervous breakdown. It's an incredible experience, an intense experience, because you're made acutely aware of the fragility of life. You know, there was a little hole I was able to look out a few inches square onto an apricot tree. If you ask me what I did to pass the time. To survive, you have to break time down. You no longer see it as 7 days, a week, a month, because therein lies madness. And so you break it down into routines. I'd have tea in the morning and sit at my hole and look at the apricot tree. And then I would wash. There was a little hole in the corner, our toilet facilities and a bucket. And then you would do some exercise. We also had a radio, which was my other window onto the world, and that was a great comfort. But you have to be careful because what can be a comfort can also break you. So I had two photographs of my two children. And in fact, if you looked upon that too long, that could break you. So I would limit myself to 3 minutes a day where I would look at these two photographs of my six-year-old and my four-year-old. But I was well treated, and they actually had a court hearing where they told me I'd been found innocent. And I believe there had been some kind of investigation. It took 3 months. I don't know why they didn't Google me, and I remember asking them that. It would have been a lot quicker than traveling around Afghanistan saying, did you meet this man ever? Despite finding me innocent and saying I am a journalist, they then told me off an aside that, in fact, the Shura then voted to kill me anyway, to send a message to other journalists not to do what I'd done.
And your captors, they didn't publicize your kidnapping with a video or anything like that. And in fact, they insisted on secrecy or said they would kill you. What did they want? Was it money?
The group who I approached to make contact with the Taliban immediately thought about money. You know, you have to, when it's an odd world, when you're crossing the border illegally and you're getting to insurgents who are the most wanted men in the world, you can't ring up the yellow pages. So my contacts were smugglers and low-level Taliban, so they're not the most trustworthy people in the world. And I think they, with some members of Siraj Haqqani's Taliban, all along the line were thinking about this being a money-making operation. So then people higher up in the Haqqani network took over the kidnap. Mm-hmm. And they were aware they couldn't ask for ransom and put me on video because I've made a number of documentaries about the Taliban which have been broadcast not only in the BBC but also on Al Jazeera, and it would have been politically damaging for them to have kidnapped someone like me who's actually taken the risk to film with them and actually put their opinions on air around the world. I'm not saying in a supportive manner, but I have reported them.
The Haqqani Network is also said to be responsible for the kidnapping of David Rode of the New York Times. He was spent 7 months in captivity before he escaped this summer. Did you ever think that you might have been able to escape?
Yeah, a number of times. And I've spoken to David's translator. He's a good friend of mine. And they were held in Waziristan. It struck me, having talked to his translator about their situation, there's obviously a lot of similarities. I think we were held by the same group, so you could see this sort of modus operandi. There were a number of times in our compound where the family were asleep, and after 2 months, and they trust me, they allowed me out. There was an outdoor bathroom, and I remember timing it that I could go to this toilet for up to 5 minutes, and I could have therefore escaped. But when they escaped, they were within about 150 meters when David, a New York Times journalist, escaped. I think it was 150 meters from a Pakistan military post. But we were deep in the mountains, surrounded by training camps. And he was there twice as long as me. And I suspect had I been there in that hole where I was kept twice as long, I think I would have escaped. But I would have had to walk for 2 or 3 days through these mountains festooned with Arab. There were Arab checkpoints on the roads. I'd heard from the young boys in the house, you know, they'd go to the market and be stopped by Taliban checkpoints or even Arabs. And you really don't want to run into an Arab checkpoint in the mountains if you're a Westerner. So, but I remember thinking, you know, will you regret? It's one of those decisions, you know, you realize if I don't escape and then when they're about to behead me, boy, I'll regret not taking this opportunity. And I can imagine that's exactly the thoughts David Rode and his translator were going through and thinking if they do escape, it would lead to death, a certain death if they get caught. And I thank God when I heard that they'd, with hindsight, they'd made the right decision. I don't think there is a right decision without hindsight.
You know, after you were declared innocent, how did your release come about then?
It became very political, as all of these situations are when... I'll give you an example. I was listening to an American spokesman, a military spokesman, saying, you know, on the radio, the tribal areas are a safe haven for the world's leading terrorists, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. And a Pakistan spokesman came on and denied it, but I couldn't hear his denial because the test firing from all the training camps was so loud, I had to turn up the radio to hear his denial of the fact that there were training camps. So, and that was my biggest fear, that I would never be able to leave because I was politically embarrassing. But, they knew all along I was a journalist. I'm quite well known in that part of the world and for the documentaries I do. I think there were some security concerns for them that I'd managed to go across the border and send messages which had been received by Siraj Haqqani. And obviously they're thinking, well, if a journalist can do that, people fighting them could send more than a message to that person. So they interrogated me for a while to sort of work out how I'd got to him via messages. And also they, I think, came under influence and pressure from Pakistani authorities saying, you know, if you have got him, you know, this is not going to look good for us. So in the end, negotiations took place between Afghan intermediaries and my TV company got messages out to them that, you know, one, if they tried killing me, it would be announced how they'd invited me. So there was quiet talks going on. I was then moved from the mountains in a burqa at one point, you know, the blue tent the women are forced to wear. And then I was moved to a second house, safe house, and in the end they released me a few days later.
Journalist Sean Langan was held for 3 months by the same group that may be holding a U.S. soldier. We'll have more with him after a break. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Sean Langan. He's a British journalist and documentary filmmaker, and last year he was kidnapped and held for 3 months by the Taliban group known as the Haqqani Network. This is the same group believed to be behind the kidnapping of American Private First Class Bo Bergdahl, who is still in captivity. As we said earlier, Private Bergdahl's captors released a video where the young soldier says how much he misses his family, and he pleads with Americans to try to get U.S. troops home from Afghanistan. Sean, when you watched that video, what did you think?
Well, a number of things. I mean, it's incredibly evocative. I know there's been conjecture about how he was kidnapped. Did he walk off the base himself, etc.? And, you know, no one likes to watch someone, you know, an American telling the government what to do or to pull out. But I think during captivity, we don't know what he's going through. And so what he says, whether it's genuine, he's being coerced to say that, I think that's something you can leave until later. What it also shows, though, is the level of sophistication by the Taliban, and that's why people are assuming it's the Haqqani network for a number of reasons. One is he could have been taken by low-level Taliban or even locals with Taliban connections or criminals, but Haqqani is really in charge of the entire eastern front of the Taliban on that part of the border. So if he wasn't kidnapped by Haqqani, the chances are he would soon be passed along to the Haqqani network. And you see in the video the fact that they've presented him with some tea or juice and some food. He's clean. It's very different to the videos which were released under Zarqawi in Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Do you remember in the Iraq war, you see these horrific, harrowing, horror movie style videos where the hostages were there and the kidnappers were behind them wearing black and then bearing knives and putting them to the throat. And those eventually backfired. And this is nothing like that. They're very careful to present him. They're trying to show, look how civilized they are by having no one with a gun to him or a knife. He's calm. We don't know what's happening when they're not filming. And they know exactly, or in their mind, they think America's weak point is its emotions and its family. So that's why they're asking him questions about his family. What do the other families of American serving soldiers, how are they reacting? There's a very deliberate propaganda message being sent. I mean, first of all, his head's been shaved. Even if he had shaved his head previously, but it's newly shaved. And it's like a mirror image of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda prisoners in U.S. prisons. So, you know, these aren't a bunch of country hicks in a little village. I mean, he's the first U.S. prisoner captured by the Taliban, and they're going to milk this propaganda for all it's worth. But I remember sitting in a room a few days before I was released, rather like his, surrounded by people. In fact, they were watching and were encouraging me to watch jihadi videos of beheadings and American soldiers being killed by sniper fire. I was watching that with children, bizarrely. You just sort of lock down, you don't think about things, and you just grit your teeth. And that was at the end of my captivity, and I'm looking at him, and he's at the beginning.
And he's a U.S. soldier.
He's a U.S. soldier, so he's not going to be afforded any of the niceties I was.
If he is in the hands of the Haqqani network, is he in Pakistan?
It makes sense to move him to a place where it's going to be harder to find him. Who knows? I mean, yeah, I was kept on the other side of the border. The New York Times journalist was kept on the other side of the border. So it wouldn't surprise me if he was being held somewhere in Pakistan.
If you could speak with Private Bergdahl, what advice would you give him?
Well, I fear for him because he's a soldier, and that puts him in a very different position. You bond with your captors, and I bonded with over many months, and it was painstaking effort on my part. It really was. I'd plan it every day, what I was going to say to the man who brought the food in, not to say too much at the beginning to warm him over. You can't just start pleading and saying, I'm going to convert, I love you. It's a slow psychological game of chess. And in the end, actually, the family of the house where I was offered me some kind of protection, saying they wouldn't let the Taliban kill us. And they, in fact, let us make a call, which helped save our lives. So bonding, keeping yourself together, whatever you do, and even though I said my translator went mad, you really are lost at sea in those situations, and you either float or swim, but there's not much more you can do. In the case of the New York Times journalist, they had this lucky break where they escaped and they were able to walk to a nearby camp. And unfortunately for this American soldier, the Taliban have learned from their mistakes, so they're not going to ever allow him that kind of chance.
I have to remind you that at the beginning you said that you decided enough was enough and you weren't going to do this anymore. So I'm wondering, do you miss it?
Well, I was a fully paid-up member of the War Junkie Society. one of the things which I really miss is being embedded, as they say, with U.S. soldiers. As a European, we normally visit the East Coast and West Coast and maybe go to Chicago in between. But when you're traveling in Iraq, Afghanistan, it's like traveling through the hinterland and the heartland of America. You meet people, soldiers from all over. And to share with them, as I have with British soldiers, their hard times and under fire, was an incredible privilege. And after you've been covering that kind of dramatic, important story, I don't really want to be sent out to interview David Beckham and how he's going in LA with his team, whatever they're called. Doesn't really pull my whatever it pulls. But
so what are you doing?
Well, the other important thing that soldier will go through when he's in there, you become acutely aware of other people suffering, because for the first time in my life, I was scared, terrified of the knock on the door at night, rather like countless generations were terrified of the knock on the door in dictatorial countries or in war zones. And I remember thinking that if I'm going to make a documentary, if it can in any way help shape or form opinion about injustice or shed light on countries and poverty. I remember when I was doing captivity, hearing on the radio about Somalia and the suffering of this mother who every time her son went out to look for bread, she was never sure if he was going to come back alive. So I'm going to Zambia to make a documentary in Africa, and I actually may be able to bring my children along on this one for a brief stay. So I'm looking forward to that. I'd also say, though, you know, for me, I was released actually this time last year, and I'd lost 30-odd pounds. I'd lost 5 teeth and had malnutrition. But I look back at that as a privilege in some ways, because it was, you know, it's a bit like Scrooge, the Christmas tale by Charles Dickens, where when you have death at your door, or like the ghost of Christmas past, you really have an incredible experience where you review your life and you realize where the mistakes you've made and how to put it right. And I had that. And my Christmas Day was when I was released.
Sean Langan, documentary filmmaker and father, speaking with us from the BBC in London. Thanks very much, Sean.
Thanks, Deborah.
With cities and states around the country scrambling for new ways to raise revenue, a battle with voters over new taxes is a typical outcome. But in Oakland, California this week, voters overwhelmingly approved higher taxes on the sale of medical marijuana. Medical marijuana has been legal in California for more than a decade, and some say allowing any adult to use marijuana and then taxing it could help with California's budget problems. Richard Lee is president of Oaksterdam University in Oakland, which is a school started in 2007 that's dedicated to the pot industry. Welcome, Mr. Lee. You teach pretty much one subject, am I right?
Right. We call ourselves a trade school for the cannabis industry. So we teach everything from the politics and legal issues of cannabis to cooking with cannabis, horticulture, hash making, things like that.
And this is a big industry in California.
We estimate already that there's over 1,000 cannabis outlets that are doing over $1 billion in business, and then overall, the illegal ones altogether are about $15 billion. So yeah, there's a lot of taxes that could be had.
So these 1,000 cannabis outlets, these are in California that are providing medical marijuana?
Correct.
And so this move in Oakland to tax medical marijuana, you're pleased with this move?
Yes. It's a lot better to be taxed and regulated than it is to be thrown in jail. We like to say it's cheaper to pay the taxes than it is to pay for lawyers.
But if it's legal for medicinal reasons, you wouldn't be thrown in jail.
Well, you got to remember, it's not legal federally yet. It's still against federal law. And even though Obama and the Attorney General have said the DA will stop raiding clubs here, we still need to change the laws to get it totally legal. And then also, we very much believe that it should be legal for adults, not just medically, that it is safer than alcohol. It doesn't cause the violence and overdose deaths that alcohol does. So I'm not happy until we get it legal for all adults, not just for medical patients.
So legal for recreational use as well.
Yeah, I don't like to say recreational. I mean, do you say recreational when you talk about Budweiser or Jack Daniels? You know, you just say it's for adults or for social use.
Oakland officials say that they expect to raise about $300,000 in revenues by taxing medical marijuana like this. But the city has, what, an $83 million budget gap. Not a lot of money.
Right, but it could bring in a lot more in the future, because we're looking to expand the number of cannabis outlets in Oakland. And then also, the way the law is written, it will apply not just to medical, but to the adult cannabis clubs that are here in Oakland that we're working to fully legalize. And then also the production facilities and nurseries, the places that provide the products to the cannabis outlets. And so in the future, when all those things are added to the tax roll, that'll bring in millions.
What does it do, something like this do, the more legitimization, if you will, of marijuana use, what does it do to prices?
Well, eventually it's going to bring them down, and they have come down some, but I think they'll come down a lot more when we regulate the production side, the growing. Right now, we just have the retail stores regulated. We don't have farms that are, you know, totally regulated and taxed and allowed. But I think that's going to be happening next, and then the prices really will come down.
Does this initiative in Oakland mean that you're going to have to pay more in taxes?
Yes, our taxes, our business license tax will go up to $45,000 a year. That's actually one of the smaller taxes we pay. We pay $300,000 a year in sales tax, plus another $500,000 a year in payroll taxes, and a $30,000 permit fee, as well as property taxes. So we already pay a lot of taxes. This will just be one more.
All right. Richard Lee, president of Oaksterdam University in Oakland, California. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now this note about California's budget problems. Early today, the state Senate approved a plan to close California's $26 billion budget deficit. The package now moves to the state assembly. If it's passed, the plan would reduce about 60% of the deficit by cutting core services such as education and some corrections programs. The rest of the money will come from tapping into local government funding, and at least 130 California municipalities are threatening to sue the state to try to keep that from happening. We'll be back in a bit. It's Here and Now. The police union in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and several other police groups are speaking out today in support of the officer who arrested prominent Harvard University Black Studies scholar Henry Louis Gates last week. Police eventually dropped the disorderly conduct charge against Professor Gates, who says he was targeted because of racial profiling. But the officer involved, Sergeant James Crowley, says when he responded to a possible burglary at Gates' Cambridge home, Gates became angry and said things like, "I'll speak with your mama." Police have asked both President Obama and Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick to apologize for being critical of police in this case. Lieutenant Charles Wilson is a 38-year law enforcement veteran and national chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Ironically, he's at a conference today teaching young people and their parents what to do if they're stopped by the police. And Lieutenant Wilson, can you start by telling us, what does this training involve?
Basically, what we talk about is the common sense approaches to handling police interactions. It's called making certain that you're able to walk away from a battle that you can afford to lose. We explain to people, stay calm, show the officer some courtesy and respect. Don't badmouth him. Don't run. Don't fight. Because we know from experience and history that these are all things that will affect your interaction with law enforcement adversely.
So this is a nationally recognized program where you teach young people, primarily people of color, how to deal with officers so you make sure that there isn't a confrontation almost exactly like the one we've been talking about with Henry Louis Gates.
That's correct.
What do you think of the Henry Louis Gates conflict?
Well, again, what everyone, white, black, or indifferent, must accept as fact, the officer was there for a legitimate reason. He received a phone call, a radio call, indicating that a possible crime was in progress. He responded. That's what he's required to do. He got there, observed a party inside. He made an attempt to obtain identification from that party. Again, that's exactly what the officer is required to do. Once he made that identification, that's where I see the difficulty having arisen. Regardless of whether Dr. Gates provided that ID willingly or grudgingly, okay, he did, in fact, provide identification to indicate that he was the legal resident of that place. Once the officer did that, his next move likely was to determine, were there any other legal entanglements? Let's say Dr. Gates is married, maybe the wife had a restraining order out, and that's why he couldn't get in the house. Okay, so once you check that, you find out that that's not the case. You still have positive ID that this is the person who lives here. The next process should have been, everything appears to be good. If you need any further assistance from the police department, call us. Sayonara.
However, though, when listening to the sergeant involved here describe what happened, he says that repeatedly Professor Gates was yelling at him and was almost instigating something. Now, disorderly conduct is separate. He wasn't charged with breaking into his house. He was charged
with... Disorderly conduct occurred after Dr. Gates went outside the residence. Okay, that's what he was arrested for, his actions and activities outside the residence. Based on that, the officer did what he was supposed to do.
But I'm just curious, if you do have someone who an officer has come up to question about something that was a legitimate incident for the officer to question, if the person who's being questioned continues to angrily confront the officer, what other recourse does the officer have in order to maintain any sense, any sense of authority in that kind of a situation?
Unfortunately, law enforcement officers are held to a somewhat different standard than everybody else. We're expected to take verbal abuse. We are expected to take insults. If I, as a citizen, call you as an officer out of your name, make disparaging comments about your family, so forth and so on, yes, you will get mad. Does that rise to the level of an offense to make an arrest for? No, it does not, never has, never will. Okay? What Dr. Gates should have done, instead of allowing himself to be led outside and again causing a scene and legally placing himself at risk of being arrested for disorderly conduct, walk the officer to the door, shut the door behind him, go back in the house. Nothing anybody can say.
So both sides were really in the wrong here. Mm-hmm.
Yes, in my opinion, and again, I'm basing that on 38 years of experience. Mm.
Do you think that there was racism here?
No, and I think everybody needs to get past that too. I don't believe that, at least not from what I have read in the reports and the various reporting that has taken place on this since it occurred. I don't believe that it was a racially biased issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, is race involved anytime, every time law enforcement interacts with somebody from communities of color? I will tell you yes, emphatically. It's a constant and continuous entity in anything we do. Okay. Was racial profiling involved? I will tell you likely no.
President Obama said Cambridge police acted stupidly.
I would say to you that I think the president could have chosen a better term. I do, however, firmly believe that the president of this country, and I don't care whether it was Barack Obama, George Bush, John McCain, or whoever you want to put in the office, should and must speak out in regards to issues regarding race. He should and must speak out regarding issues pertaining to the means and methods by which law enforcement interacts with people of color in this country. These are continuing issues. They are not going to go away. Racial profiling is, in fact, an existing entity. It is the 800-pound gorilla in the car every time you walk down the street.
So it is sort of a fine line, then, that everyone has to walk here. But it's not. These are not the issues that were involved in this case.
No. Based on everything I have seen, based on reading the report itself, okay, I don't believe that it was a racial profile issue.
Lieutenant Charles Wilson is the national chairman of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. Lieutenant Wilson, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
For your thoughts, go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us, or you can send an email to letters@hereandnow.org. And before we go today, from writing for Barbara Streisand to new live shows and appreciation of Steely Dan, you're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Up on the hill. People never stand. They just don't care.
This is the title song from the CD Asia, the double platinum album from the rock band Steely Dan. For more than 35 years, Steely Dan's been mixing jazz and pop in some unconventional ways, and now it's doing that live. The band, which was known for its meticulous attention to detail in the studio, is loosening up a bit. On its current international tour, Steely Dan is playing some of its classic albums in sequence, including the Asia album. But can Steely Dan recreate those detailed, highly produced sounds live? Here and Now rock critic Tim Riley checked out their live performance of Asia and is here to give us his take. Tim, welcome.
Hi.
Remind us, who is Steely Dan?
Well, Steely Dan is not one person, and it's more of a concept than it is a group. At the heart of Steely Dan is the songwriting team of Walter Becker and Donald Fagen. They met at Bard College in the late 60s, and they were intense jazz freaks, the kind of fanatics who chased down obscure records and prize outtakes, which, of course, made them outsiders to the hippies of the Woodstock era.
And so when did they really get started?
Well, they sold an early song, actually, to Barbara Streisand in the early 70s. It didn't chart, but it was on a very popular record of hers, and the song is called I Mean to Shine.
And Tim, this is Steely Dan.
It's an early Steely Dan written song, and, you know, it convinced them that they were on the right path, that they could sell songs and they could get on the charts. Within a year after selling a song to Barbara Streisand, they had two major hits in 1972, Do It Again and Reelin' in the Years, and they cracked top 40 radio with these beguiling hooks that were draped over these very fancy, intricate jazz chords. And the lyrics were bizarre. They kind of chew irony up for breakfast, and then they mastered a stylistic tightrope, sneaking jazz licks and fancy chords into sturdy pop jingles. Your everlasting summer, you can see it fading fast. So you grab a piece of something that you think is gonna last. Well, you wouldn't even know a diamond if you held it in your hand. The things you think are precious, I can't understand. Are you reeling in the years? Throwing away the time. Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Well, that one's really popular. Yeah, and you can hear, a heavy, distorted lead rock guitar on top of some acoustic piano and some jazz changes. And their career is as curious as some of their outre lyrics. For starters, they did everything backwards. In the 70s, they toured only reluctantly, and then not at all for a long time. So at the height of their first phase with the release of Asia and Gaucho in the late 70s, they had hits like Peg and Deacon Blues and FM and Hey 19. They were studio hermits in this period, and they had almost zero public profile.
How did they go from being reluctant in the 70s to perform live to where they are now?
Well, they took a long hiatus after Gaucho, and they did a lot of solo projects. But ever since the early 1990s, they've discovered a huge live audience. Their 2000 comeback album, Two Against Nature, won them a long overdue Grammy for Album of the Year. And ever since, the band has been touring every single year, as well as producing new work. And another album, Everything Must Go, followed in 2003. And both Becker and Fagen have continued doing solo projects. Your daddy's footfalls on the rain-slick streets. You try to keep up with your tiny feet. You take it easy, baby, nice and slow. Little Walter got a ways.
And this song is by Walter Becker. No relation, by the way. And it's from one of his solo projects, the title song to his 2008 CD, Circus Money. But, Tim, I want to go back to Steely Dan and the current tour. How do you think they sound playing their albums live?
You know, they hire the best players in the business, and it's not really that's not really an exaggeration. I mean, the competition to play on a Steely Dan record or tour is very intense, and they're known for being very finicky. I talked with one musician who knew a player who played on a session who said, yeah, that was a good session. Those guys are really fussy. They're intensely, they're just really every single detail, every single nuance. In fact, this is where they do take some criticism for being too meticulous. Mm. But the touring band that they put together is so highly, I mean, the level of musicianship is just not to be believed.
but I do wonder, though, how this sort of meticulous sense of control mm-hmm. in a live setting, mm-hmm. How those two can sort of balance each other out to have an effective concert.
Well, I think they're very conscious of it, and I think they strike a very good balance. You will hear a guitarist take a solo, and he'll be quoting liberally from the solo that you know on the record. So he obviously knows the solo. It's in his ear the way it's in all of our ears. But he's also dancing around it and doing new things with it and going off on his own for long stretches. You know, the other night we heard Black Cow, and you could hear in the piano solo, the guy knew the recording piano solo, but he was doing his own version of it and then taking off from there.
But what about the songs on the albums that are, let's say, B-rate songs? I mean, how do the fans react to that?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you're talking about a band that came of age during an era when the album really was the signature piece of work. It was seen as something like close to a novel. Like it really achieved this level of people were not going to pad out albums. People of Steely Dan's caliber. And so with Steely Dan, you really don't have B-tracks. You don't have songs where people are going to get up and go get a beer. Every single song is really, you know, of a very high standard. So playing the whole album through is actually an interesting way of them getting to know the material in a new way and for audiences to learn how the stuff works live in a new way.
Tim, the name of this tour is Rent Party 09. You mentioned that Steely Dan uses a lot of bizarre lyrics, a lot of irony, a lot of wordplay. Is that, would you say that's a trademark, really?
Oh, that's definitely a trademark. And Rent Party is actually sort of literal for their world because it's, you know, the economy crashes and so we're throwing a rent party. But it has a tradition in jazz of being, you know, we're jazz bows and we're out playing all the time and we have to throw ourselves a rent party to make the rent.
All right. Well, we'll see if they do that, won't we?
Yeah.
All right. Here and now, rock critic Tim Riley with his take on Steely Dan. Tim, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.